This week on Pop of Culture, we reach for the stars.
So some people come in and they say it's a camera or a telescope. It is kind of like that, but not really. It is a projector, and it can put up about 4,000 of the brightest stars.
We get behind the control panel at Indiana's largest planetarium to learn how they put on a show.
And we'll talk to a metalsmith, and equestrian, and mom, whose work reflects her multifaceted life. Coming up.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Welcome to Season 2.
We're so thankful for you, yes, you, for listening and supporting the stories we share.
And we can't wait to dive even farther into the arts and culture scene in East Central Indiana. Speaking of, if you have an idea for Season 2, tell us at indianapublicradio.org/contact and select Pop of Culture.
We're going to start this season looking up to the sky.
I am sitting underneath the stars with Dana Thompson, well, sort of. We are in the Ball State University Charles W. Brown Planetarium, and I am with Dana Thompson, who is the director here. This is, I feel like my voice has to be like a little softer because it's really dark in here, Dana, and the stars are beautiful. There's constellations. There's the Milky Way. What an amazing place to be, right?
Absolutely. It is amazing. And yeah, it does feel like you kind of have to whisper in here. Sound travels very oddly. We are in this interesting shaped room. It's curved. We have this curved ceiling. It's a dome ceiling. So we can project onto it the night sky and make it look realistic. So sound does get focused here in interesting ways. Mm-hmm. But we try not to put anyone to sleep too much with our calm voices, even though I'm told I have a calm voice, a relaxing voice.
Yes.
I've narrated our meditation program actually in a very soothing way.
Yeah.
But we do try to also have some energy behind it as well.
Yeah. Well, it is just beautiful. I love coming here. I've been coming here for quite a while, and I understand with the new building, you're celebrating quite a milestone.
Yeah. 10 years since we opened to the public in the Charles W. Brown Planetarium. But before that, we had an older, original planetarium that serviced the community for 47 years.
47 years.
Yeah.
That is a long time. And I understand, is this the largest dome in Indiana?
Yeah, this is the largest planetarium in Indiana here at Ball State University. We have a 16-meter dome. It's about 52.5 feet. It's about 2 feet larger than the planetarium dome at Notre Dame, actually.
Yes.
So we did get a little bit larger of a dome by 2 feet than Notre Dame's. And yeah, we opened 10 years ago this month to the public.
How long have you been here, Dana, and what drew you to this type of work?
I have been at Ball State University since 2010 when I started as a graduate student in the Department of Physics and Astronomy when I was a master's student there. I actually got my master's degree in physics from Ball State. So it took me 2 years to do that. And while I was doing that, I got my experience, my first experience inside a planetarium as a graduate assistant working at the planetarium, the older original planetarium here. And that was a smaller 30-foot dome in the basement. We tend to joke that Boy Scout groups are still lost in the basement of the building trying to find that planetarium because it was hidden.
Yes.
This new one is attached to the side of the building. So it is something that you can see from the outside. It is domed from the outside, and you know that it is a room for space, basically, for space exploration, to study the stars, to study the night sky. So while I was a graduate student, I was studying the night sky in the classroom, and then I had school groups come to the planetarium, and I was able to share what I learned in the classroom with them in an interesting and engaging way. And that was really exciting because I was able to just have fun with the science, with the knowledge. Mm-hmm. And there is no test in the planetarium. It wasn't a intimidating space. Yeah. We just could have fun learning together as a group, as a team, basically. And that really drew me to the science communication part of mm-hmm. science and STEM.
Were you interested in the night sky as a kid?
When I was growing up, I did have a really good view of the night sky because I grew up in the middle of cornfields. Ah. And then those cornfields turned into subdivisions. Mm-hmm. So my sky quality where I was got a little worse. However, I didn't really know my constellations until I was teaching them. And I learned more about the sky, learned more about constellations. And I feel like when you know more about something, you can get more interested in the subject, more passionate about it. And that's what really drew me to it, is knowing a little bit more about it and getting more excited about it. Growing up, my dad was really excited about astronomy, though. Mm. He would have a telescope and he would set it out to things and say, come out and look at it. And we'd kind of begrudgingly go and look at the telescope and say, yeah, that's cool, Dad. Okay, can we go back inside? But now actually sharing it with people and, again, knowing more information about the objects rather than it just being this kind of abstract thing in the sky is really interesting. So learning about it in a planetarium and then going out and seeing it in the real sky is really exciting for our guests, which we do. We have these public programs on the weekends, Fridays and Saturdays, where they learn about the content. And then afterwards, if the weather is nice and if the time of day is right, then we can share that with them in the real sky and point a telescope and have them see the object with a real telescope, which is really great.
That is really great. We're looking at like a lot of different constellations in the sky. How many are there?
There are 88 constellations, 88 official constellations marked by the International Astronomical Union. Mm-hmm. 88 constellations, the same as the number of keys on a standard piano, if that helps you remember
it. That's interesting. Yep. As we look up there at them now, what do you have a favorite story behind one of them?
Yeah, that's a common question, is if I have a favorite constellation or a favorite planet.
Yeah.
And I tend to joke that we're not really supposed to have favorites. It's just like children. You're not supposed to have a favorite planet. I do have some that I am a little bit nostalgic around, yeah, or I have good memories about. And that's the constellation Cygnus the Swan. I really like Cygnus the Swan. One, it looks like what it's supposed to look like. not a lot of constellations do.
Right, right.
So, for instance, we're looking at Orion the Hunter up in the sky, and I can point to it with my red arrow and explain it to the folks. So we have these two stars that mark his shoulders,
yes,
three stars in a row for his belt here,
yeah,
and his little sword off of his belt, kind of the string of stars below that belt.
Yeah.
And then two stars for his feet or knees, depending on how you draw him. He has a shield out in front of him, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can see with good imagination maybe what we're seeing here, all this detail. But most people just see the stick figure in the mm-hmm. sky. And that's great. That's wonderful for a constellation. Not a lot of constellations look like this. For instance, right next to Orion the Hunter in the sky, just to the left of him in the sky from our perspective here, is this constellation of a unicorn, Monoceros. And we look behind this overlay, this picture of this beautiful unicorn, mm-hmm. and there's like nothing in the sky, no bright stars. And they say, you wonder, how did they get that, right?
Yeah.
I think someone just really wanted a unicorn constellation in the sky, right?
I mean, who wouldn't want a unicorn in the sky, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I get it.
So Cygnus the Swan, you can actually make a swan out of, and unfortunately we don't see it right now in the sky. It is more of a summertime constellation. It's actually a part of the asterism, this recognizable group of stars in the sky. We call those asterisms. They're not official constellations in the sky. But it's a part of the asterism called the summer triangle. It's up all the time in the summer. So we have Cygnus the Swan. It has this cross shape for its long body and then the cross beam for its wings, and they actually go out and extend even farther. And so it does look like a swan in the sky.
Okay.
And it actually, if you can see the Milky Way, this band of light going across the sky, the galaxy that we live in made of hundreds of billions of stars, and our sun is just part of it, the Swan constellation actually looks like it's flying in the Milky Way. So that's really cool. And also, the beak of the swan is called Alberio, and Alberio, with a telescope, with the help of a telescope, you can actually see that it's not just one star, like it looks like in the sky, but it's actually two. And with the telescope, you can see that it's a bright blue star. Ooh. Right next to a gold, like yellow-orange star. Wow. In the sky. So you can see the color of those two. And that's one of the first stars I really learned how to point a telescope to. It's one of the first constellations I learned besides the popular ones like Orion and Ursa Major, the Big Bear. So there's a lot of things with Cygnus that's really interesting. And there's a really popular black hole in Cygnus, this one, called Cygnus X1. There's a whole bunch of really great things.
That is a lot in one constellation. That, no wonder you like to tell that story. That's amazing. I didn't realize that there were so many different color variations for the stars.
Yeah, absolutely. I can actually bring up a quick picture.
Okay.
So this picture is a picture of a star cluster. It's one that we usually bring up with our school children, and this is kind of the first really dynamic things that we bring up. And it just blows their minds, and they think it looks like fireworks because it does. It's this picture of a whole group of stars that are all different colors. There's blue and red and yellow and orange and white. No green or pink stars. That would be really cool, but there's not any in this picture. But we have this range of colors of stars, and we can talk about star temperature with this picture, with the young kids that come through our planetarium completely for free, by the way.
Yes.
And so they see this, and we talk about temperature and light, and that the color is telling us information, like the blue stars are very hot stars and the red stars are the least hot. Still very hot. All stars are very, very hot, but the blue stars are the hottest and the red stars are the least hot.
It's the opposite of what you would think.
Exactly. Yeah. So we say it's opposite from what your faucets say at work or home or school or what have you.
It's beautiful. And there's so many. It literally is a blanket of color. It's just, I wish our listeners could see it right now. Even more reason to come to the planetarium, right? How many children, like school groups, come through here every year on average?
Yeah, every year we get about 10,000 school children visiting the planetarium. So about 200 groups total.
Wow. And they are from all over East Central Indiana and beyond, because this is, I mean, where else are you going to go for a planetarium like this, right?
Yeah, we get a lot of school children from, of course, Muncie, but surrounding communities as well, as far as Indianapolis. And we've even had groups from Ohio come.
Wow. Talk a little bit about the shows, not just for school children, but for families that you offer on the weekend. Talk about the different types of programming the planetarium offers.
Yeah, of course. We have public programs on the weekends, Fridays and Saturdays. We have shows typically at 6:30 on Fridays. And then on Saturdays, we have a 3:30 family-friendly show. So that's things like our Sesame Street show that's really popular. We have a Magic Treehouse program that's pretty new, very, very popular. We just got a new program that is about accidental astronauts, basically these kid astronauts that go to the moon. That's a nice new family program that we have that we're premiering next year.
Oh, nice.
We have programs about sending humans to Mars for the first time and about our new James Webb Space Telescope. So we have the new James Webb Space Telescope out in space taking beautiful pictures. We just did a whole program about that. That was original to Ball State University, completely live and interactive. Then we have other kind of pre-recorded programs, movies about finding life on other planets, about the birth of our solar system and Earth, about how astronomers do science, basically a whole range.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love it that you create programs in-house. Talk a little bit about, you know, when that started and how that feels to create something here at the planetarium.
Yeah, so we've been creating planetarium programs at Ball State for many, many years before the Charles W. Brown Planetarium was actually created, as far back as the old planetarium. Our previous director, Dr. Ron Kachuk, would create programs and put them together for the older planetarium. And then that inspired me when I came in to create my own shows from looking at what he did and building from that. And so when we had the new planetarium put in, we were able to do more. We have this new technology, this full dome technology that allows us to project onto the entire planetarium dome these movies and images. It's kind of like an IMAX theater in a way. And fortunately for us, it's very powerful and allows us to go to different planets, different parts of our universe, and see things in a lot of detail. For instance, exploring Saturn's rings. So that was actually the first planetarium program I created. We had Saturn and Beyond, and that was created only about a year or so after we had the Brown Planetarium open, which is a very short time for a show creation. Usually it takes about 2 years or so to create a full-length program for a planetarium. And so Saturn and Beyond was our first production, and it was the first one that we were able to declare intellectual property with at Ball State and sell and distribute to other planetariums around the world. Then we've also partnered with other departments on productions. We have our Halloween program that we partnered with the IDIA Lab, the Department of Anthropology, and the Department of Theater and Dance, because one of the students from Theater and Dance actually came and narrated the program for us.
That's very cool. So we are now sitting behind, do you have a name for this? But like the command station?
We are sitting behind this control panel and this console, basically. We usually call it a console, but it's this whole control panel. There's a whole bunch of buttons and knobs and sliders. There's an iPad. Actually, there's two iPads that control the system. It controls our audio. It can actually also control our entire planetarium software from anywhere in the dome, so that allows us to present in front of the audience if we ever wanted to, which we do for school groups so we can really engage with them up close. But you can see that the control panel here, it has these numbers for our date, and it is kind of like a DeLorean screen, and you can actually punch in any date plus or minus 10,000 years and the planetarium system will take you there. It's just for pretend though, right? But it will take you there, and it'll show you what the sky actually looked like back 10,000 years ago and 10,000 years into the future. Beyond that, the mathematics for showing where the planets will be and the moon will be, those positions, those very detailed positions, kind of breaks down plus or minus 10,000 years. But then we can also do more with our digital system, because we have this unique hybrid system here. And with our digital system, we can actually show the sky tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years into the future, and show actually what we call proper motion in the sky, which means that the stars that make up the constellations, they're all moving in the galaxy, and they shift ever so slightly in the sky. But over long periods, you can actually see that shift in the sky and see constellations kind of morph into new shapes. So the Big Dipper might not actually be the Big Dipper in about 100,000 years. It'll be a little wonky.
Interesting.
So if I speed up time by hundreds of thousands of years, you can actually see those stars shift. And then back to today. And then back in time.
Interesting.
And so a little while ago, I was talking about the Northern Cross. And that makes up or helps make up the Swan constellation, Cygnus, the Swan, here in the sky. And so if I go forward in time, you can see that in
That's the far future. Different wingspan.
It is a very different wingspan. Yes, for sure.
Talk a little bit about the giant purple behemoth in the center of the room that kind of makes all of the magic happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We have this big purple thing in the middle of the room, and that is our star projector. the star projector. That means it projects or puts up tiny little points of light all on our curved ceiling, our dome ceiling in here. And it makes it look like nighttime, even though it's daytime outside. So some people come in and they say it's a camera or a telescope. It is kind of like that, but not really. It is a projector. Mm-hmm. And it can put up about 4,000 of the brightest stars.
Wow.
That we make our constellations out of. And it can fill in the Milky Way with 10 million points of light representing stars. You can actually take a pair of binoculars in here with that technology and see things in more detail. Just like the real sky, because it has a resolution equivalent to 70K, 70K, because it uses gears, lenses, LED lights, and more to mm-hmm. put up the sky. It's not a digital projector. It's an optomechanical projector. It's an analog projector. So it's not limited to digital pixels or that kind of technology.
Oh.
And then on either side of that purple guy in the middle, mm-hmm. we have two fisheye projectors. Those are digital projectors, and those put up things like movies and pictures in here.
Gotcha.
And that is put up with really great resolution still at 4K. So it's 4K versus 70K, though. So far, we've only been really seeing the digital projection. And if we switch over now that we've been in here for a while, you can see the other projection here, which does look, in my opinion, much more realistic.
Yes.
And this is what a lot of planetariums do not have. They do not have this kind of a sky quality anymore because a lot of planetariums are going to digital technology.
It's so beautiful. I feel like I need to have my sleeping bag and like a cup of cocoa and yeah. like a little fire going. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. And we get a lot of oohs and ahs in here. Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's what we try to do in here is we get that reaction and we have that suspension of disbelief in here where they feel like they're looking at the real sky. And the old planetarium, the previous director, he said that one time someone actually thought they opened the planetarium dome and were looking at the real sky. And we have very similar technology, actually better technology now yeah. here in the new planetarium than the previous planetarium.
It really does give you that feel that it yeah. just opened up and you're getting this once in a lifetime view.
And I think that it's really powerful having this experience in a room full of people. We sometimes, unfortunately, have to turn people away because there's so many people who want to come out to sure. our shows. We see 152. And so you're surrounded by people who want to learn alongside with you, who want to experience this with you. And so there's that community aspect as well.
Yes.
You're not just walking to your car after work, looking up at the sky, thinking it's beautiful, and being alone in that. You are with other people and enjoying it alongside family and friends.
Oh, that's such a good point. Is that one of the things that you love the most about what you do, Dana? What is it that you love the most?
I love the connection in the planetarium, how we can connect with the audience, how mm-hmm. it's a two-way conversation with them, never a lecture, never this one-way conversation where I'm talking at them. I love when we have this audience participation and reaction, and we do have that. We have a lot of audience members actually respond to any kind of activities we give them, any tasks we give them in the planetarium, whether it's finding a planet in the sky together as a group or a constellation together as a group. We're all in this together under this planetarium sky. And that kind of connection is really powerful, especially in the planetarium.
Well, Dana, thank you so much for hanging out under the stars with Pop of Culture today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Michelle. It was wonderful.
I can't believe I got through the whole thing without a single space pun.
Dana Thompson is the director at the Charles W. Brown Planetarium in Muncie. This is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Kara, do you do that whole New Year's resolutions thing?
I do. I, over time, have learned to do less, not make a giant list, focus on a few things, you know, to be successful, hopefully.
Yeah.
I have hope right now.
Yeah. I love the idea of doing a New Year's resolution that you know you're going to accomplish.
Right?
Yeah. I'm going to get up every morning. I mean, I'm not specifying a time. I'm not... Could be 8 in the morning, could be 4 in the afternoon, but I'm going to get up every morning.
Well, consistency, I don't know about anybody else, is difficult. So that's one thing on my list.
Yes,
this year.
I'm going to live my life. That's what I'm going to do in 2025. I'm going to.
Nice.
Yes. A popular resolution is to be more involved in the community. So we thought we'd listen back to our interview with avid volunteer and amazing human being, Nancy Carlson.
She is a retired associate professor and chair of BSU Telecommunications, which is now media. Nancy is very involved in the community, which includes being a volunteer right here at IPR Studios for WBST Muncie. And we are grateful for that. Thank you so much for being here today, Nancy.
I'm a big fan of public media.
Yes, we love that. Well, we wanted to talk to you today. We want to talk to you today about what you're working on and just share a little bit about that with us.
All right. I'm a volunteer all over town. I like to volunteer because it keeps me busy and it keeps me on a schedule. So a lot of the volunteer activities I do have a theme. Recycling, I think I would call that theme. For example, some friends and I do, we call ourselves the Merry Menders, which sounds like a 4-H club, but down at the Common Market at 8th and Hoyt, we do free mending to anyone who walks in the door with a ripped pocket, or one guy wanted a shirt jack changed to a straight across shirt and he wanted us to add pockets. Someone brought in a bridesmaid's dress last week and it had 3 layers, 2 satin layers and 1 chiffon layer, and we cut off 6 inches, which was scary. The first cut was scary. After that, it was too late. You know, that's exactly how it had to be. You can go shorter, but you can't go longer. And so we do free mending 1 to 3 on Thursdays for anybody with a hole in their pocket or people who can't sew. They may be able to sew on a button, but they don't know how to shorten something. So we do that. And then I run the Afghan Refugee Sewing Circle. A couple years ago, 2.5 years ago, actually, Muncie was lucky enough to get some of the 78,000 Afghan refugees who fled Kabul when the Taliban took over. Yes. And we have 150 or so Afghan refugees and about 30 women. And they all sew way better than I do. And they get together monthly. And today we got together at the Children's Museum. So it was lots of fun because school's out and they brought their kids. So we give them, once again, recycling. People give me their fabric. People who used to sew have a closet full of what we call stash. And they bring their stash and we give it to the Afghan women. And they love it. And they take it home and they make pillows or seat cushions or tunics for themselves or whatever. And then at church, we quilt, and we quilt with the same thing. People give us fabric, cotton fabric in this case. We cut it up into 10-inch squares and make quilts for Lutheran World Relief, which is international-wide. It goes to 25 different countries. And people don't just use our quilts for bed covering. They often hang our quilts as room dividers in their huts to make a one-room hut, a two-room hut. So that feels really good. And then I volunteer every Monday at the teacher's store, which is called Classroom Connections, and it's on South Madison Street. And it's one big recycling project because people like Joann's Fabrics and Staples, for example, they'll bring us things that might have gotten damaged in shipping, or a customer let a ream of paper fall onto the floor and it tore the wrapper. And then they really can't sell that for retail, but they can give it to the store and we give it free to teachers. Teachers practically cry when they shop in the teacher's store because everything's free for them.
So you have a lot of traffic in the store.
Well, they work by appointment. You mm-hmm. can't have too many people at one time. We only have so many shopping carts. But yeah, a lot of this is for teachers whose schools have enrollment that qualify for free and reduced lunch. So it's really the poorest schools get to shop there for free.
Well, I'm very proud that we have that in our community.
There are only 40 nationwide.
Oh.
And there are two in Indiana. So we feel really lucky that we have a teacher's store that's 20 years old. So it's been here a while. But it's a thrill to work there because all I do is put things on the shelf. And yesterday, I just went through boxes of magic markers and threw away the leaky ones because we don't want to give leaky markers to a teacher. So the work is quite menial, but it needs to be done. And I really enjoy it because there's no pressure, which is the way retirement should be.
Yes. You're active, but you don't have to feel any strain.
I set my own schedule. And, you know, I decide that I'm going to go in Mondays to the teacher's store. And Monday afternoons, I sew for Civic. That's another thing. Mm. Civic Theater has a lot of costumes that have actually been donated by the public, either after the death of someone or things go out of style. They give it to Civic Theater. Or it's wacky things like fur coats that nobody wears anymore, or tie-dye shirts, you know, from the 70s or whatever, and we create costumes out of them. So don't be shy about donating your weirder-looking things to Civic Theater, because we create costumes from there.
That's great. Is there a place or a time when people can make donations, or just...
The box office, which is the easiest access at the theater, is open at 1 o'clock on Tuesday through Saturday and on show nights. And so that's the easiest thing to do, is to drop off things. Sometimes we can't use it. If you donate a lot of ordinary things like shirts you can find at Goodwill, we'll just return them to the mission or something like that. But if they're very interesting, like a bathrobe full of boa feathers, we'll go, whoa, we're keeping that one. And I don't know why, because we don't know what play. But right now we're working on Mary Poppins, which opens this weekend. And we made 184 costumes for that show. Not me, 13 of us. So 13 there's 13 people who sew.
Ah, I'm sure there's some colorful costumes to be seen.
You should go.
I will. What else would you like to talk to us about?
Well, one of the things that really gets to me is reading to third graders at Grissom. If you aren't reading at level by third grade, your chances of success are really quite slim. You won't be able to read directions. You can't read recipes. You can't read a can to see how many calories something has in it, or whether you're, you know, gluten-free or not, because you never really learned how to read. And it's heartbreaking to see an 8-year-old who still is trying to work on sound. And I read to third graders, which are usually 9 or 10, and I don't read to them. They read to me, or we read together. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of many, many adults, mostly volunteers from senior citizens in Muncie, who goes to different elementary schools in Muncie and works with third graders, because that's when there's a test called iRead, and it determines if a child is reading at level or not. We're so worried about children who don't read at level because they may never catch up. Mm-hmm. And the most shocking thing is that those children might be high school dropouts and then never get any training past the school where they left, and might commit a crime because they don't have any other means of making an income. And that makes me so sad. And if there's something we can do about that, I want to help.
And you are, that you're changing the trajectory of many children's lives by participating in this. And
well, actually, it's just me. It's just a couple or one a week or something like that. Mm-hmm. But if lots of people would volunteer and help kids read, or read to your own grandchildren, read to your own nieces and nephews, read to your kids aloud or help them read, it'll make a big difference.
It does. And the more people can participate, the better.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today and telling us about all the things you're doing to support our community and make it a better place.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nancy Carlson, volunteer extraordinaire in Muncie, Indiana. It's time for our regular segment, What Are You Working On?, where we ask artists, well, about what they're working on.
We talk to folks creating both full-time and free time to learn how their lives shape their art.
We are here with Sandra Geyer, as she is called in her professional artist media, or Sandy, as she said we can refer to her. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I know that you're an artist and a mom and an equestrian and a horse mom. Mm-hmm. And I wanted you to tell us what you are working on right now.
So as you mentioned, I'm a metalsmith. I work in a lot of media, but I've been mostly focusing on metals for the last like 5 years or so. And I make a lot of objects and also wearable objects. And they are very much inspired by my experience as a caregiver, particularly the mom side of it, but also a little bit of the horse caregiving comes into, which is where I incorporate some of the horse hair into my projects. But most of the objects I make come from a place of either being inspired by the forms of tools of caregiving, or I'm incorporating some of the leftover materials that happen in the acts of caregiving. So like I have pieces made out of candy wrappers that I've fished out of my son's pockets when I do laundry. I have pieces that one of my favorite pieces actually has a little vial with my kids' fingernail clippings in it. So there's a kind of a combination of precious materials and then these leftovers that are basically the trash that comes from caregiving, but putting them together and hopefully making people think about like what is really more valuable and what is precious.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and you said you make wearable art. So is this mm-hmm. vial with your child's nails in it a necklace?
So it is, there's a historical form of jewelry called a chatelaine, which when I discovered it, I was like, oh, this is perfect, because the chatelaine is something that modern people might be familiar with if they've watched some historical TV shows like Downton Abbey, because it's usually worn at the waist, and it's traditionally where the keys would be held, so the person who is in charge of the manor would have all the keys, and so symbolically it represents like access and power, and I just thought it would be sort of amusing to combine it with the very unglamorous tasks that you do if you are this person who is in charge of taking care of everything.
Nice. Can you talk a little bit about some more of the items of care that mm-hmm. you use? Because it's really making me start to think about what that could possibly mean.
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned the nail care chatelaine. So the vial collecting the fingernails is just one component of it. It also has some other chains that hang off. And so it has like a little container for the nail clippers themselves. And so the idea is if I always had this kind of, you know, on my person, it would be very easy to, when I noticed that my kids needed their nails trimmed, to go ahead and trim it and then collect it. And then I also have, this one is actually for my horse. It's I don't know if you ever heard of a Victorian hair catcher. So they would have these jars and it would have a hole in the lid. And so after they brushed their hair, they would take the hair out of the hairbrush and kind of stuff it in this jar. And when they had enough, they would use it to make sort of like a little, like an accessory that they could use to put back in their hair and like add volume and kind of like bump their hair up. So
jar?
Not the jar. It's just the jar was for collecting the hair, and then yeah, and then they would kind of use that hair to create the piece that would lift their hairstyle up.
Wow.
So I made one of those, but it clips to my belt, and then when I'm brushing my pony, especially in the springtime, he sheds a lot. And so I would just have these handfuls of hair and I would just be stuffing them into this little jar. And then when it gets condensed and I open it up, it's almost like a little nest of hair that it creates. And those were kind of interesting little forms, again, made of trash. But
well, And is it? You know, I feel like you've transformed things from trash to art.
I hope so. I hope so. Yeah, it seems like if it was just trash, I would be able to throw it away, but I just can't seem to. So,
yeah, I like the idea of using things that you would ordinarily cast off as functional. The idea of having the clippers right at the ready. Is there any other things like that you have that you wear on your person and you utilize in another way?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of like another finished object. So I have, this is also in the form of a chatelaine, but it is a little dustpan and broom, and the chain that holds them together is of cast Cheerios that I have picked up on the floor from underneath where my children eat their breakfast, because there is always a lot of material there for me to collect. So I took the Cheerios and I cast them in bronze and I made it into a chain. And so now that is the part that keeps the components together for my little dustpan chatelaine.
That's fabulous. Can you talk a little bit about the horsehair and what you've made with that? And what's your horse's name?
Sure. Okay, so his name is Eeyore. That's his barn name. And his name was Eeyore when I got him, and it's so perfect. It suits him. Like, he's just like, okay, I'll do whatever. But when he was doing occasional shows, his show name was Thanks for Noticing. And so I've had him for longer than I've had children, and so I've been taking care of him for, I think I've had him for 18 years now. And he has a very long, beautiful, wavy mane. And so when I would comb his mane, the comb would be full of his hair. So I felt like I didn't want to throw away what I should be throwing away after I finished brushing him. So I was just collecting these piles of hair. And then was able to start incorporating it into my work and doing some weaving with other materials like metal wire, and then weaving the horsehair as well and kind of combining them in different ways. And I liked the way the horsehair is a little bit less easy to control, and the wire, I can kind of put it where it belongs and it stays there. So I get this kind of balance of order and chaos.
Nice. I want to, well, okay. You've had your horse longer than your children. I just want to know, like, how old your children are now, and do you feel as if your art is evolving as they evolve in terms of the care, or what does it look like now?
Yes. So, yeah, so the pony I've had for 18 years, and then my oldest child is 12. So I have a 12-year-old boy, and then I have an 8-year-old girl. And I think the sorts of things that I'm getting from them that I'm using in the art is definitely changing as they get older, because I also have some pieces that I've made with like their drawings, because I don't know, I think maybe a lot of parents have this experience where their kids are very prolific creators, and so your yes. house is just, like, sometimes I come home and my whole floor is just covered in drawings, and again, they're all precious, you can't just scoop them up and throw them away, at least not when your kids are watching, so that has changed a little bit, like, as my kids get older, and I think they're a little bit more discerning now with their art, too. Like, they don't necessarily show me everything that they draw. Because when they're little, they're so proud of everything. And then when they get older, it's like they kind of do a self-filter where they're like, they'll show you the really good stuff, but I want to see it all. And so I have been making some pieces that are out of enamel, which is like fused glass on metal, but using my kids' drawings as the design for that. So that way, even if the papers don't last forever, I have this little, I usually turn them into brooches again. Yeah, so I can wear them and just remind me of when they were a little bit younger. So I think having these objects, it helps me to kind of remember some of these moments that maybe don't get as much recognition in the moment. But when you think back, you're like, yes, that was a very important memory.
Mm-hmm. And then you have captured it in some way.
Exactly.
Well, can you tell us where we could find your work?
Sure. I have an Instagram account where I post a lot of my work, and then a lot of some of my times my students' work as well, because I do teach art. And that is at Coppermare. That's my handle on Instagram. And website incoming soon, I hope.
Nice. So we appreciate you being here today, and it was very lovely to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
It's that time again, Kara. It's time for the arts calendar. All things going on. Well, some of the things. We don't have time to do all the things going on in and around East Central Indiana. I'll kick it off.
Great.
Shall I? All right. The School of Art at Ball State is proud to present Object as Conceptual Workbook, an exhibition by Michael Lorsung and Dwayne McDiarmid in the Ned and Gloria Greiner Art Gallery at Ball State University. Michael Lorsung is an assistant professor of art, primarily sculpture, at Ball State University, and Dwayne McDiarmid is the area chair and professor of sculpture and expanded practice at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Lorsung works in craft-based media, meaning metalsmithing, glass, ceramics, and woodworking. McDiarmid constructs sculptures, designs performances, and initiates social intersections in fine art venues, digital communities, and within remote landscapes. That sounds pretty cool. Gallery hours are Tuesday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
That sounds really amazing.
Doesn't it?
Michael Lorsung has done some work in Muncie, and we just got a sculpture that he created through an immersive learning project.
Awesome.
Yes.
So perfect timing for this to happen so that people can learn a little more about him and what he does.
Yes. The third and final film in Anderson's Paramount Theater silent film series will be shown on Saturday, January 11th. The film will be The Kid, starring iconic Charlie Chaplin. Experience the magic of the silver screen with live organ accompaniment on the majestic Page organ. The movie will begin at 7:30 p.m.
Speaking of classic films, Cornerstone Center for the Arts is hosting Public Domain Theater the third Wednesday of each month in the auditorium. On Wednesday, January 15th, the film will be the 1929 British thriller Blackmail, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. The movie begins at 6:30 p.m. A discussion will follow the screening.
The Coffee and Cabernet series continues next week at Ball State's Pruce Hall with bluegrass bassist, singer, and songwriter Missy Raines. She's the most awarded bass player in the history of the International Bluegrass Music Association. How cool is that?
That is so cool. I love that.
The music will begin at 7:30 p.m. next Thursday, January 16th. The Coffee and Cabernet series at Pruce Hall includes 10 world-class performances in an intimate setting while enjoying a selection of tasty beverages.
Tasty beverages. And Moulin Rouge the Musical opens Tuesday, January 14th at the Old National Center in Indianapolis. Shows continue through Sunday, January 19th. Enter a world of splendor and romance, of eye-popping excess, of glitz, grandeur, and glory. If you have a glorious event Pop of Culture listeners need to know about, let us know at indianapublicradio.org/contact, then select Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. Our first episode of Season 2 was produced by Luke Jones, who also happened to knock out the previous 45 episodes, and was hosted by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Kara Duquette. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.
Okay, good.